Picture a woman who worked from sunrise to sunset in cotton fields, endured the whip like any man, bore children who would be sold away, and resisted slavery with every fiber of her being, yet whose story was erased from history books. Angela Davis's Women, Race, and Class forces us to confront an uncomfortable truth. The American liberation movements we celebrate often built their victories on the backs of those they claimed to champion. Published in 1981, this work remains unsettlingly relevant because the fractures it exposes between white feminists and women of color, between middle-class reformers and working women, between those who preach solidarity and those who practice it, still run through our movements today. Davis doesn't just recount history, she reveals how the very people fighting oppression can become complicit in it when they fail to see beyond their own experience. This isn't ancient history, it's the blueprint for understanding why contemporary movements still struggle with inclusion, why hashtags don't always translate to justice, and why liberation delayed for some means liberation denied for all. Most slavery narratives miss this. Enslaved women weren't just victims, they were the economic foundation, shattering every myth about feminine fragility. While 19th century white women were corseted onto fainting couches, Black women plowed fields, hauled timber, and worked in coal mines. 7 out of 8 enslaved women labored in the fields, not the big house. When profit mattered, gender disappeared. Slaveholders valued Black women as labor units, and the whip made no distinction between male and female backs. The exploitation went deeper. After the international slave trade ended, Black women's bodies became breeding grounds for future slaves. Courts ruled that enslaved children stand on the same footing as other animals. Pregnant women received no mercy. Some were forced to lie face down over holes dug to accommodate their bellies during whippings. This was capitalism in its purest form. Human beings as balance sheets, wombs as production facilities. This horror inadvertently created equality white women wouldn't achieve for another century. Enslaved men couldn't become patriarchal heads of household when everyone was equally powerless. Black women and men worked side by side, shared domestic duties, and resisted together. Oppression stripped away gender hierarchies, revealing that strength has no gender and survival requires partnership. Resistance took countless forms. One woman ran a midnight school, teaching hundreds to read and forge passes to freedom. Anne Wood, a teenager, commandeered a wagon and led armed children northward. Others poisoned masters, sabotaged crops, fought off sexual assaults, and refused to be broken. Harriet Tubman conducted over 300 people to freedom and became the only woman in American history to lead troops in battle. Women in Maroon communities fought like Spartans alongside men. Frederick Douglass remembered the rebels who shaped him, his cousin who fought an overseer's sexual attack, Nellie, who remained defiant through brutal whippings, and countless others whose names we'll never know. Yet popular culture gave us Uncle Tom's Cabin, where Harriet Beecher Stowe portrayed Eliza as submissive, driven to action only when her child was threatened, white motherhood in blackface. This distortion suggested maternal instinct, not hatred of bondage itself, motivated resistance. The real story was more threatening. Black women resisted because they rejected slavery entirely. They passed to their descendants a legacy of self-reliance, hard work, and absolute insistence on sexual equality, a legacy crucial in battles to come. The women's rights movement celebrates its abolitionist roots, but the full story reveals troubling blind spots. White women like Lucretia Mott and the Grimke sisters found their voices fighting slavery, yet most struggled to connect their oppression to that of working women and Black women, a failure that would fracture the movement. Prudence Crandall showed what courage looked like. In 1833, she defied her Connecticut town by accepting a Black girl into her school. When white parents boycotted, she recruited more Black students. The town responded with boycotts, vandalism, and arrest. She was an exception. The Grimke sisters grasped that women's oppression and slavery were interconnected. Angelina Grimke declared in 1863, Until he gets his rights, we shall never have ours. Liberation is indivisible. But by 1848, the movement's limitations surfaced. The Seneca Falls Declaration focused on middle-class grievances about marriage and property rights, ignoring mill women who had been striking since the 1820s and black women like Maria Stewart, who had been lecturing on women's rights since the 1830s. Ain't I a woman? Sojourner Truth's 1851 question wasn't rhetoric, it was an indictment. Describing her labor, strength, and maternal suffering, she exposed the racism poisoning the movement. White women initially didn't want her to speak, but her impact was magical. She reminded everyone that black women were equally women, despite differences in race and class. Truth's intervention exposed an uncomfortable reality. When white feminists spoke of women's oppression, they meant their own. They complained about being barred from universities while black women were barred from learning to read. They protested lack of property rights while black women had been property. Other black women contributed mightily despite being written out of history. Frances E.W. Harper lectured as poet and abolitionist. Sarah Ramon's anti-slavery speeches in Britain helped prevent British support for the Confederacy. Jane Lewis regularly rode across the Ohio River to rescue fugitive slaves, risking her life in darkness and cold water. These women didn't just support the cause, they were the cause, fighting for freedom on multiple fronts while their white sisters often failed to acknowledge their existence. After the Civil War, the movement faced its first test. Would white feminists support black male suffrage even without women's suffrage? The answer revealed shallow roots. When the Equal Rights Association voted to support the 14th and 15th Amendments, granting black men the vote, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony responded with openly racist rhetoric. Stanton argued that refined and cultivated women had more compelling claims than emancipated Africans. Frederick Douglass tried to explain the urgency. The ballot was literally survival for black people facing murderous riots, but Stanton and Anthony couldn't see beyond their own grievances. Their response exposed the truth. Their commitment to black equality had always been conditional. The movement fractured along the color line, a wound that has never fully healed. A quarter century after emancipation, freedom remained hollow for black women. The 1890 census revealed over a million worked for wages, 38.7% in agriculture, 30.8% in domestic service, conditions barely distinguishable from slavery. They endured sharecropping contracts designed for perpetual debt, homes where sexual assault loomed constantly, and a convict lease system that arrested black people on any pretext, working them until they dropped dead. Domestic work became a racist trap, degrading because black women performed it, while they were deemed inept and promiscuous for doing such work. As W.E.B. Du Bois noted, any decent white man would rather kill his daughter than let her accept domestic employment. Northern migration brought no relief. Employers shared Southern attitudes. Negroes are servants. Servants are Negroes. In Pennsylvania, 91% of black women workers were domestics, including former teachers fired due to prejudice. Yet resistance emerged from oppression. Black women grasped what white feminists missed. Housework itself was the problem, not just who performed it. Carrying the double burden of wage labor and housework, they understood women's liberation required not merely equal pay or voting rights, but socializing domestic labor and ending capitalism's economic stranglehold. Their experience revealed a radical truth. True freedom demanded new social institutions and challenging the profit motive's dominance. Davis's analysis remains painfully relevant. Black women still earn less than white women, who earn less than men. Domestic workers, predominantly women of color, remain exploited and excluded from labor protections. The black rapist myth still fuels police violence and mass incarceration. But Davis offers vision alongside critique. True liberation requires understanding how oppressions interlock, how racism serves capitalism, how sexism divides workers. Middle-class white women's comfort often depends on exploiting poor women and women of color. The unfinished work demands coalitions across every divide capitalism creates. It asks not, what's in it for me, but how do we all get free? It requires transforming not just laws, but the economic system profiting from exploitation. Davis's urgent message, liberation is indivisible. The revolution isn't complete until the most oppressed are free. Until Black women facing racism, sexism, and poverty live with dignity, none of us are truly liberated.